Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here today for episode number 448. In just a moment, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Isabel Knight. She is a human-centered designer and end-of-life guide. And we talk all about that, bringing human design into end-of-life care. But she's also the president of the National Home Funeral Alliance. We talk a bit about that as well and the benefits of being a member of the NHFA. So stay tuned. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. For announcements today, I want to let you know the screening and discussion that I have held just recently for the documentary film, The Last Ecstatic Days. I spoke with Aditi Sethi about that a couple of weeks ago. That screening sold out very quickly. So I know there were a lot of people who wanted to attend who weren't able to get in. So we have added on a second screening just to try to accommodate people who missed that first one. It will be held Friday, April 12th at 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. As I'm recording this, I don't yet have the link for it, but check the show notes for this episode, eolupodcast.com. And the link should be there by the time the episode airs. I should have a link that you can click on and just register and get tickets if you'd like to attend that screening the second time around for everyone who missed it. So that'll be Friday, April 12th. I also want to thank my latest supporters on Patreon, Kelly G and Yuka Itahashi. Thank you so much for your support. And for all my Patreon supporters, there are bonuses that you receive for joining the community at Patreon. Coming up this week, you'll be getting the end-of-life news update for the month of March, which I put out every month, just a curated list of news items that have happened that are of interest in the end of life arena over the past month. And then you'll also soon be getting the What to Watch recording, which has four or five programs that I suggest that you might want to take in during the coming month that deal with death, dying, grief, or the afterlife. So those are a couple of bonuses that everyone who joins my Patreon community receives. So you can go to patreon.com/EOLU if you're interested in that. I also want to thank two new supporters to my $10 for 10 years campaign on PayPal, Pradeep Berry, who donated in memory of his wife, Constance Ann Berry, a PhD from Harvard Business School. Thank you so very much. And I'm happy to honor the memory of your very dear wife, and thank you for that donation. And then also Kathleen Lynch for your donation through PayPal. I appreciate all of these so very much. It means everything to me, not just financially to help offset the bills that I have to pay every month, but emotionally and spiritually. It shows me that people are listening and that you appreciate the work that I'm doing here with this podcast. So thank you for that. You can go to eoluniversity.com/support if you want to learn about those three. There are three different ways you can make a contribution: through Patreon, PayPal, or just buy me a coffee if there's a particular episode that you really like. So that's at eoluniversity.com/support. So now we'll move on with my conversation with Isabel Knight. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to welcome my guest, Isabel Knight. Isabel is a human-centered designer and end-of-life guide. She founded The Death Designer, a company that provides design services for death care businesses and nonprofits, as well as end-of-life planning services for people at every stage of life. She's also the president of the National Home Funeral Alliance, a national nonprofit that teaches people about community death care and how to conduct a funeral from home with or without the help of a funeral director. And you can learn more about Isabel's work at thedeathdesigner.com. And I guess, oh, I should say the National Home Funeral Alliance, is that home funeral? Can you tell me, Isabel, home funeral?
Oh, what's the website?
Yeah.
Yes, it's homefuneralalliance.org.
Homefuneralalliance.org. Okay, for the National Home Funeral Alliance. So, Isabel, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've been excited to talk to you ever since we met at the Endwell Conference back in November. And so I've been looking forward to being able to just sit down and have a full conversation with you. And I was hoping that you would start by just telling us your story and what draws you to do this work, because you're a young person. And, you know, I'm just curious about what brings you here to this place.
Totally. Well, it's funny. My path to this is very sort of random. It was very much, I was in a phase of my life where I was like, are you familiar with improv? Like the concept of like, yes, and
yeah,
right. I basically, my entire career has just been a yes. And, so back in 2017, I was trying to start a business, and, basically I did one of these startup competitions. I was trying to start a tech company, and then that was like a terrible experience. And so then after that, I was like, okay, I'm looking for business ideas that don't involve relying on like a web developer to build a, you know, a app to have my business basically be like a tech platform. So my friends knew that I was looking for business ideas. And I had a friend who was also on the Frisbee team. I played Frisbee in college. And at our Frisbee alumni game, he came to me and he was like, Isabel, my uncle just died and my dad is in charge of playing the funeral. And we are Jewish, so we just need a plain pine box for a casket. And we can't find anything that is less than like thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so they ended up just going to Home Depot and getting some wood and making a casket themselves. But he was like, Isabel, I think you should go into making a more affordable casket. Mm-hmm. And I was really into listening to how I built this at the time. So I was like, oh, this is just like the Warby Parker story, where the people who founded Warby Parker were like, why are glasses so expensive? And it turns out glasses are just expensive because there's one main casket, or there's a one main glasses manufacturer, Luxottica, and they can just charge whatever they want. And the same is very much true in the casket space. There's like one casket manufacturer, I think they have like, don't quote me on this, but like 88% of the market or something. And they have these, you know, contracts with funeral homes that are very exclusive. Being like, if you want to do business with us, you can only buy our caskets. So I was originally thinking of going to caskets. My whole idea, I moved to Philadelphia from DC in like 2020. And my whole original idea was to partner with local artists in Philadelphia to find people who were pre-planning their funerals and make the casket into this work of art as like a legacy project. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a casket just like sitting in my house. I like rent, so I have to schlep it from place to place. But and that's what convinced me that, you know, for a second I was thinking of doing caskets direct to consumer, and trying not to go through funeral homes. But I just, the experience of having to take this casket with me from place to place was like, oh, I don't know if direct to consumer is necessarily the strategy here, especially because then you're competing with like Costco and Walmart and things like that. But anyway, I kept hearing from people that I talked to as I was doing market research for my casket business that they just needed somebody to help them figure out what to do when someone dies. Like most of the people that I had talked to who ever had an experience of trying to, you know, be the planner or the executor for somebody who had died was just like, I was just so overwhelmed at that moment. I didn't know what to do. And so then from there, I kind of went down the Google rabbit hole of like, you know, learning about death doulas. I did an ELDA's death doula training. And then from there, I was already in my day job doing human-centered design. So I was just like, you know what? I should just take the human-centered design that I'm doing now. And I used to work at Fannie Mae. So I was doing it in like the mortgage space, totally unrelated, obviously, to death care. But I was like, why don't I just take this skill that I already have and just use that and apply it to death care? Which has been very, like, has been awesome, because the death care space is very Shall I say, like, not the most innovative space. And
Yes.
that's what human-centered design is all about, is like trying to help create innovation and design things in a way where you're involving the user in the design of your products and services, which death care is so aggressively not. It's like I always say to people, like, death care is traumatic, expensive, and complicated to navigate, like all of which are not human-centered design, friendly traits. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into this space in the first place.
And then you ended up at the National Home Funeral Alliance, which I think we should probably tell our listeners what that is and what the NHFA provides, just briefly, because people listening may not have heard of it before.
Yeah, for sure. So the National Home Funeral Alliance is a national nonprofit that educates people about community death care. And basically, a home funeral is a funeral where there are some states where you are required to utilize a funeral director for some items, but such as transportation from, the place where someone has died to the cemetery, etc. But basically, doing a funeral in your home. And for people who don't have homes, that's why we're trying to expand our language to saying community death care more, just because, we want to be inclusive of people who also may not have access to a home. But that's kind of the crux of it, is just helping people to understand that in every state, it is your right to be able to care for your own dead. And, that involves washing and shrouding a body, that involves doing whatever rituals you want at home. And it's something that, for a lot of people, it can be more affordable to do that. It can be just, especially during COVID, when there was a lot of restrictions around going to outside funeral homes, for example. Like, some funeral homes only allowed you to have like 10 people show up at the funeral. Like, a home funeral allowed you to have more flexibility, and like you have control over your own space. And I could go on about, like, how many different reasons there are to do home funerals, but I mean, another one is also just that sometimes people have really complicated grief. And one that is not often as often brought up as the other reasons is that, maybe you don't want have a lot of great things to say about this person. Like, one person who's in our community is like, I wanted to have a home funeral so I could just scream at my dad's dead body, and like, that's complicated grief. Like, that's a legit reason to have a home funeral too, so that's essentially what we do, is we educate people about how to make home funerals happen.
And it's a membership site, is that correct? So people can become members and get information like a newsletter or something from you.
So it's free to be a member. And members receive, our newsletter, and you also have the ability to be a part of our directory. So we just have a directory on our website of home funeral providers, whether those are home funeral guides or simply home funeral friendly funeral homes, and vendors and things like that. So there is basically, we also have like webinars, but those are all open to anybody, regardless of whether you're a member or not. You don't have to like pay more if you're not a member or anything.
And as I remember, it's been a while since I looked at the website, but it seemed like there were a lot of resources there that could be very helpful if someone on their own was interested in planning a home funeral or wanted to become a home funeral guide. Like it seems like the NHFA is a good, really good place to start to get information.
The biggest sort of initiative that we've been working on for the last few years has been our home funeral guidebook, and that's a book that we released in May of last year, and it just walks you through step by step, like, how do you there's a lot of planning, obviously, that goes into doing a home funeral if you want to do it yourself, as opposed to, having somebody else do it. And so it gives you like checklists, it gives you estimates on how to like think about how much it's going to cost. It gives you diagrams on like how to shroud a body, for example. So it's that is sort of our flagship resource. And we're also currently in the process of creating another guidebook that is specifically targeted towards infant and child death care as well, because we have a little bit of that in the original guidebook, but we had, volunteers who had so much more expansive knowledge that they wanted to include, that we just decided that that was made sense as its own separate resource. But those are available through our website for free. Our it's donation based. So you could choose to donate nothing and you could get it for free.
Yeah, that guidebook is such a good idea because it seems like if you it a home funeral would be really hard at the last minute, like, oh, someone, Uncle Joe died. Maybe we should have a home funeral. It's really hard to put that together. But if you have a loved one who's nearing the end of life, that a home funeral is actually what this person would want, because there are people who know that. That's what they want. That's how they want to be memorialized and celebrated at the end of life, is a simple ceremony at home. So take advantage of these resources, start thinking and talking about it and learning, because you could pull it off. Individuals can pull this off for a loved one, but they do need to prepare ahead of time.
Yeah, one thing that I, often tell people that that might not be something that they always think about in advance is to, if you can, make sure that you, if someone, most people say they want to die at home, and in fact, most people die in a hospital or medicalized setting. And so one thing I tell people is, like, even if you think you're going to and plan to die at home, I always tell people just make sure that you know what the release policies of your local hospital or, doctor's office is when, someone dies in their facility, because there are a wide variety of policies, and, you really want to make sure that your local hospital will allow you to, take the body from them without needing the help of a funeral director. Or if you do need the help of a funeral director, just making sure you know that so you can know to coordinate with the funeral director to receive that body if you want to take them home after they've died.
And there are home funeral friendly funeral directors out there, that, as far as I understand, who will assist people who want to do their own services, but they'd be willing to step up and help with whatever legal matters were necessary.
Absolutely. We have, I'm based in Philadelphia, so we have plenty of home funeral friendly funeral directors in my area. And what part of what I see my job as being as the president of this organization is to dispel the myth that there is like any contradiction or antagonism between us and sort of like the more traditional funeral industry. Because I really think, especially as, younger, more, for lack of a better word, progressive people are going through mortuary school, there are greater and greater numbers of people who are willing and excited to support people to do home death care. And honestly, for so many funeral directors that I know, it is awesome to find a family who really wants to be really hands-on and design their own ceremony and really put a lot of thought into what they want to do for their service, because not all families are like that. And I think that that is like a very invigorating customer to serve,
Yes, definitely. And I agree with you so much. We don't need to be eliminating possibilities. We need to make all the possibilities available, because people have different needs and different preferences, and we need to make sure that we're able in our communities to meet the needs of everyone who lives here, should be able to find the services that they need.
Right. I see it as really like we're not taking away from your business. It's really like it's empowering people to see themselves as like a lot of people just don't know that this is something they're even allowed to do. Right. And, once they discover that they have this option, I really think it is in funeral homes' best interest to, in especially in states where they do need help filing the paperwork. For example, because a lot of states have these electronic death record systems that normal people don't generally have access to. Like that's a great example of a way that a funeral home can help a home funeral family or individual to, access, just be able to access death care in this country. So I think that is a great way for funeral homes to support people who want to do community death care themselves.
Yeah, definitely. I really like that idea. Collaboration is what we need
Yeah.
here in all these areas. And I was wondering, you yourself are an end of life guide, and you practice human centered design. And so I was curious about how you apply the principles of human centered design in your work as an end of life guide.
Yeah, totally. So my end of life, so my business kind of has two prongs of it. I kind of have a B2B or like business to business side where I help other death care businesses make their services and products more human-centered. And essentially what that involves is talking to your users from the very beginning. And that could look like interviews, that could look like workshops. And one of the things that is like a very common tool in the human-centered design toolkit is doing these maps where I'll create these journey maps of like from the beginning of like your service to the end, what's all of the different touch points? Who are they interacting with? And how are they feeling at every point along that journey? I think that's one of the biggest, most important parts of human-centered design is really focusing on like how at what when at what point are they the most stressed? At what point is it actually like really gratifying? You know, is there a point during the funeral where everyone is just like, wow, you know, what you want, obviously the goal is to be like, wow, that was a really amazing, beautiful experience, right? Like that's part of what we're trying to design. And so I'll do that for businesses and then for individuals, I have a local like death doula group here in Philly. I generally use end of life guide as a term more so than a doula simply because I don't do any bedside vigil or anything like that. I don't do any of the bedside work. I just do planning. So I have like a set of 8 sessions that I'll give people as a package to just have help them to go through their paperwork. Get their passwords and a password manager, like all of the pre-work that needs to happen. And if they're interested in doing home funerals, I'll like help them plan out the home funeral itself. And then, you know, often the families themselves can just hopefully be prepared to do all of the things that they need to do when the time comes themselves.
I love the way you describe human-centered design. And I just, I'm retired now, but as a doctor, oh my gosh, we need that so desperately in healthcare. I just think about how fragmented our healthcare system is. And there's so little continuity for a patient trying to go through the system, even from going to a doctor's office, then having a test done, and then trying to get the results, and then seeing a specialist. Like, no, there's no map of any of that. It's just so often the patients are just out there trying to navigate on their own and trying to figure it out. Where is it I'm supposed to go next? Why am I doing that? What is that about? And so, wow, we really do need that kind of innovation.
And one of the things that I'm really excited about is that the healthcare space, actually, I think there has been this trend towards embracing human-centered design. I think in the healthcare space, people use often this terminology of like patient-centered care. And it's a very similar kind of concept of like, you know, when you walk into a hospital, especially like I had to be in the ER, not for myself, but for my sister earlier this last summer. And, you know, when I was in the waiting room, I was just like, wow, this is such like the fluorescent lighting and like the fact that you're surrounded by other people who are sick. Like, there's just so many ways in which, like, often hospitals, when they're designed, are not even designed with the staff and the doctor's involvement, much less the involvement of the patients themselves, right? Because I think there would be so many things that would look so different if we did design healthcare in a human-centered way. And one of the, you know, things that from a data perspective that we know is that if we literally have art, plants, like pets, children, like all of those things in our, you know, nursing home setting or in our healthcare settings, like art literally lessens people's hospital stays, it lessens their physical amount of pain medication they need. Like, it literally lessens their pain, like being in a more beautiful, less stressful environment. There's so many ways that we can be making hospitals and, you know, our death care institutions more human-centered, for sure.
Yeah, because I under from working in hospice, I mean, hospice is, I mean, values human-centered, patient-centered care, and it's
Right.
probably the best example of it in all of medicine. And yet still there's still fragmentation at times, and especially people who are not yet in hospice but who are going through the treatment system and are most likely going to end up in hospice at some point. It's just really sad that there isn't more concern about how we could make it a much better, more positive experience for them.
Yeah, have you read Atul Gawande's book Being Mortal?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I really think of I like when I try to explain the concept to people, I often talk about his whole thing with the parrots and how he brought the parrots into his nursing home, and or not him specifically, but like there was a he was telling a story of someone who was a director of like a nursing home that did that, and it literally just made everyone's lives so much better just having these parrots that people had to care for because they then had a sense of purpose. And I feel like that's like such a great example, that I think a lot of death care people can have heard of before, of like how you can be more human-centered in the spaces that you're curating and the work that we're doing,
And I love that because that tells us it can actually be a simple thing. I mean, and when we think about, oh, we need to try to improve end of life care, it feels so big and unmanageable and so vast. The systems are huge and they're entrenched. And how are we ever going to make a change? But honestly, it might be one place at a time, one day at a time, one little thing that we do that actually makes a difference, and that inspires us to keep going wherever we are, wherever we're serving people, to try to bring in the human-centered concept as much as we can.
Yeah, and one of the things that I always like to talk about when I talk about when I explain sort of what human-centered design is all about is, the brand OXO that like makes kitchen devices and bowls and stuff. So OXO is like one of the best examples of what we call inclusive design, which is where instead of designing for the quote-unquote average person, you want to design actually for the most vulnerable population. So OXO, they test all of their kitchen appliances with people with arthritis and other mobility issues. Like those are their primary like testers. And they also do testing, with other people who don't have that. But the point is that that then creates like they put like rubber bottoms on their bowls and then like they have these like chunky bicycle handles on like their peelers and things like that. And the point is just that, when you're designing for the most vulnerable, actually what that results in is better results that everybody benefits from, right? Because we all find those to be actually easier to use, regardless of whether you have arthritis or not.
That is so true. I'm so glad you told that story because I love OXO products. In fact, that's always what I look for when I need new utensils for my kitchen, just because for the very things you mentioned, they're easy to use and functional and they fit my hands well and it just feels good to use them. And I had no idea, but that concept makes so much sense of designing for the most vulnerable people that we're going to be serving.
Right. Because like in the death care context, for example, I do this workshop called like the Death Designer Workshop. And so I did one that was specifically focused on like trans and non-binary people a few years ago. And one of the sort of takeaways from that is like, if you're designing a system that doesn't have the assumptions that are so often sort of assuming that you're not going to be trans or non-binary, and those are things that people like then have to work around the system that wasn't designed for them. Just having fewer assumptions generally about like what name you want to go on your gravestone so that you're not dead naming people, or what you want the obituary to say, just like lessening the amount of assumptions, I feel like was one of the general takeaways as to how we can help create a more inclusive death care system to trans and non-binary people. And of course, that same takeaway is just helpful for everybody, right? Like if we just make fewer assumptions generally about, what your mom or dad wants when you're planning their funeral and you just ask them and plan ahead, like all of it kind of builds into the same general thesis of like, let's actually have active conversations about what people want instead of making assumptions, and that would benefit everybody.
So true. Wow. This is just such good wisdom that's kind of inspiring to me because I see how it can fill in the gaps. And we have so many gaps right now in all the ways we're offering service to people at the end of life. And to take this approach would just make a big difference. And even if each one of us were just thinking in our own way, in our own work and how we operate, how could I make my work more accessible to the most vulnerable people.
Right. And
It's
part of why actually human-centered design is something that came out of like the tech industry, right? And in the tech context, it was sort of like, okay, like there's all of this pressure to do things really fast because you're funded by these venture capitalists, and like people have all of these like fail fast mottos of like, iterate and stuff like that. And if you're trying to scale something like your app or something really quickly, chances are most of the time you're going to try to build for, the person that you see as being the average, right? Which is why so much, so many apps and so much technology is built for like cis white men, right? But as soon as you start expanding the pool of people that you're testing with and, building in things like accessibility features, so you are building for a broader pool of people, like that is what the human-centered design piece is all about, is that you can't assume that you know these other people's experiences. You can't even assume, regardless of identity stuff, you can't even assume like that you know what, interface is going to make most sense to someone. So the central premise of it is like you really need to go and interview people and, have workshops and get a feedback loop going. Because if you don't, then you make so many mistakes if you make assumptions about what is going to be most intuitive for other people, because you're not designing for yourself, you're designing for someone else.
so true. And we really have to get out of our own heads and recognize what a vast, diverse population of humans there are who all
Right.
think differently and see the world differently than me.
Totally.
Well, I'm curious to ask you this as a young person, what you feel are some of the main challenges facing the death care world today, right now. And you may see them differently than me. I'm kind of nearing the end of my career, and looking back on things maybe more than I look forward, but you're definitely looking forward as a younger person. I'm curious about what you see as the issues.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because I feel as if there is, I feel like so often my stance as like someone looking at any system sort of under capitalism is that the problem is capitalism. But like from a real sort of like for example, looking at the case of death doulas as a super hugely blossoming movement right now. I think that there is a real desire in the death care space to figure out how to make a business model for death doulas, like how to go from basically where the birth doulas were, I don't know, like 10, 20 years ago, to the place where birth doulas are now, or to go to the place where hospice was 10, I feel like there's a lot of parallel industries that I see as being very comparable to the space where a lot of these independent practitioners, whether they're death doulas or home funeral guides, but like you know exactly what I'm talking about, I feel like, having been in this space, that there's a lot of these independent practitioners out there who want to figure out how to do this work full time and have yet to figure it out, basically. Like I like most of the people that I know who are in the death doula world would love to just quit their jobs and do this full time, and are probably in some cases very frustrated with like their inability to do that. And I really, really believe that we have seen quite rapid normative change in other spaces, like therapy, for example, right? I feel like even in the span of my life, like I feel like 20 years ago, therapy was nowhere near as mainstream and widely accepted as it is today, right? And that's a fairly big normative shift. I feel like people in my parents' generation like wouldn't even say therapy. It was like such a taboo thing to talk about. And then now, if you go on dating apps, I feel like this is so common to see people be like, if you're not in therapy, like don't even bother swiping on me, So, I mean, from almost PR perspective, that's a huge win for therapy, right? And I really feel like death doulas can have a similar trajectory where we go from, the space where we are now, where no one is really that I know of. Maybe I know of like a handful of people who are trying to do death doula work full time, but for the most part, most of those people that I know who have been able to do that have been kind of getting in through these side doors where they're employed by a hospital or they're employed by I know one who was employed by like an elder care attorney's office, for example. So I think because it's becoming much more, major news organizations are publishing articles about it, and it's getting more into like just the general zeitgeist in the mainstream. More and more people are making it happen, but I totally think in like 10, 20 years, we could absolutely be as ubiquitous as therapy is, right? We could absolutely be in a space where it's like, oh, duh, everyone needs a death doula, Why are you even asking me this question? And so the thing though that I see as one of the main challenges is how does any industry go through that level of change without it becoming, for lack of a better word, corrupted by these corporate forces? Because I think essentially, like for a lot of those spaces, we've seen a lot of exposés in, news articles. Like there was a really popular New Yorker article talking about for-profit hospice, right? And like not even that long ago, like I feel like hospice was really starting to grow in like the 90s. And at that time, it was like, wow, like this is so awesome. Like we can really have this grassroots community-centered focus and, at end of life in healthcare. And it's just like, oh, like I, how do you make sure it doesn't become, the better help of therapy, of therapy? Like, how do you make sure? Because there are, I've seen so many people in the venture capital space have approached me and been like, hey, like tell me about this death care thing that I'm hearing about. And I really worry that a lot of those people who are funding these new death tech businesses are not familiar with the space. And, I kind of worry about death like doulas becoming this corporatized thing in the same way that has happened in the case in some cases of hospice. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, I feel that same worry, and I think a big part of that is because the baby boom population, of which I am one, we're such a massive force of people, and the marketing strategy. I mean, the idea that there's this huge vast market of people who are approaching the end of life out there, like, wow, there's a lot of money to be made from all these baby boomers, and so it makes sense that investors want a piece of that pie and want to get involved. And so the size of the baby boom population is an advantage in that it does help spur change. I mean, it does help bring change faster, but you're so right. Everything's vulnerable to corruption if we aren't really, really careful about how we monitor the changes.
Totally, totally. And then, like, another challenge that I would say too is that there are these really exciting new, disposition methods like water cremation or natural organic reduction, for example. And like one of the things that I don't feel like I can necessarily say because I'm not a scientist at all, but I feel like I would love to see there be an equivalent of, the Green Burial Council, which I'm sure you know of, but like for the listeners, it's kind of like an organization that is a nonprofit third party that certifies green burial grounds in the United States. I would love to see a analog to the Green Burial Council for water cremation, for, body composting, for example, because so much of the data around, for example, how much carbon is sequestered by body composting, natural organic reduction, for example, is provided by those same companies. So I would just love to see there be a third party nonprofit or organization that kind of oversees that, sort of like CANA for cremation, the Cremation Association of North America. I think that those sorts of governing bodies or agencies would be super helpful for some of these newer disposition methods that are coming on the scene.
That makes a lot of sense as well.
Yeah, because like when I go last year, I was at South by Southwest, sorry to cut you off, that there was this person who was marketing like this tree burial idea, right? And like for people who don't really understand that you need to have a body decompose first before it can become bioavailable to a tree or to a plant. I mean, it's just like any other composting. Like you wouldn't expect that you could just take all of your kitchen scraps, like, put a melon rind under a tree and have the tree eat it. Like people kind of get the fact that you need those to decompose first. But there's actually a lot of these companies that have gotten funding from investors who seemingly just don't understand. Like, a lot of these basic science principles are not really being followed when you just put a body underneath a tree, like the tree pod thing, right? In a lot of cases, even if it's not necessarily going to kill the tree, like sometimes it will kill the tree, but even if it's not killing the tree, it's not like the tree can really be nourished by someone's freshly buried body. So, like, that's also, I feel like there's just a lot of challenges in the sense that there's greenwashing that happens in this space, and people need to be aware that some of these things are just literal scams.
That's a really good point. And we need so much more education. Everyone's vulnerable because we just don't have a common body of knowledge for most lay people around death and dying and what happens and what it looks like. So people really are vulnerable to being taken advantage of.
Right? And I get why people are like, wow, it would be so beautiful for my body to become a tree, right? Like, I get why people really have this symbolic resonance around that. And I'm like, great, I love that you love that. But also, like I feel like is a very common saying, plant the tree today. If you really want to plant a tree, there's no time like the present. You don't have to wait till you're dead,
Exactly. Well, you mentioned the birth doula movement, and I wrote a little white paper on that about what the end of life movement can learn from the birth movement from way back a long time ago, and it was actually driven by baby boomers too, the birth doula movement. But I read that there were three factors that helped the birth doula movement kind of take off, and one was grassroots involvement, like just grassroots organizations, everyday people, groups like the La Leche League, and that grassroots in communities of people coming together saying we want something different. And the second thing were people inside the industries who were supporters of change, people inside who could actually make a difference inside where they were, who said this needs to be different, we've got to change things. And the third was media attention. And so it feels to me like we're so ripe right now because we have all three of those things. There's so many grassroots organizations out there and movements coming along that are just growing and expanding in communities all over. And we do have insiders. We have Atul Gawande and Dr. Ira Byock. We have all these podcasts now. There's a lot of media attention, documentaries being made, films being made, articles, like you mentioned, in the New Yorker and Forbes, really prominent publications. It feels to me like we could be on the verge of growth and change because we have all three of those factors present that were needed before. So I take a little bit of optimism in thinking back historically of what made a big social change happen before, and can we make it happen again?
Yeah, it's a really exciting time to be working in death care, honestly, right? Like that this is I do feel like we're on the cusp of potentially massive sea change in the way that we view death and dying. And I think that probably the pandemic is a very non-trivial part of that as well, right? So many more people are thinking about their mortality.
It's so true. It's so true. And it was, a catastrophe and tragic in so many ways. And yet it was a big driver of social change. And I don't think we've even begun to see the outcome of all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, obviously, you were saying, like, as a young person too, like, I really do feel like, when there are some, when people are very new to the space, I tell them to go to a death cafe. And like, the death cafes are so different depending on who hosts them. Because, like, in some instances, when they're hosted by, like a senior center, for example, like you'll get a very different flavor of death cafe that's mostly talking about like a medicalized death and potentially more like spiritual themes and things like that. Whereas, when I used to live in DC, I would go to this death cafe at the Potter's House, which was this very sort of like young, hip space. And you're talking about overdoses, you're talking about school shootings, you're talking about suicide. Like, it's a totally different, like, there's a huge swath of young people who are thinking about death, because it's just such an ever-present part of our lives, unfortunately, because we see people who are young dying in the news every day.
So true, so true.
So I always tell people, like, there is, you are never too old, like, I have my end of life plan, I have my funeral plan. Like, there is
Yeah.
no reason not to do it, regardless how old you are.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, something I left this, I didn't ask you this earlier, but you had mentioned wanting to talk about, speaking of changes happening, about the funeral rule, and because there's some changes to the funeral rule that are being considered, but I wondered if you could just explain that, what the
Yes.
funeral rule is and what changes are being considered, just as we're talking about changes that need to happen, perhaps.
Absolutely. So, okay. So the one main regulation for funeral homes is the funeral rule, which is basically regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC. And starting in, I want to say November 22, 2022, they initiated a ANPR, an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which means that they were soliciting public comment because they were thinking of changing the funeral rule, right? And they listed like 40 different questions that the public could comment on. But the main thing that they were considering revising about the funeral rule was they were considering requiring funeral homes to post their prices online. So today, the funeral home or the funeral rule states that, like, you have to make prices available to people. But you can do that, like, if someone calls you on the phone, you can email it to them. Like, you're not required to publicly post it on your website today. And they are Thanks, I think, in large part to the advocacy of the Funeral Consumers Alliance, which is a national advocacy group. It was exactly what it sounds like, that advocates for funeral consumers, aka all of us, because we're all gonna be
True,
funeral consumers
true.
at some point. They have done an incredible job of, basically trying to get the FTC to revisit the funeral rule for a long time. What I've heard is that the FTC in an ideal world is supposed to revisit, their laws and regulations every 10 years. And it had been a lot, way longer than 10 years since the funeral rule was last looked at. And I think it's one of those, like, the squeakiest wheel basically gets the attention. So, like, basically they really had to pressure the FTC to, consider looking into the rule. And so thankfully they have. And the price transparency that would come with, like, making funeral homes post their prices online would be so incredible, because I'm part of my local Funeral Consumers Alliance in Pennsylvania, and I cannot tell you how many hours I have spent literally just calling funeral homes trying to get their prices, because that's literally, like, what we do. Like, that's pretty much 90% of what we do. 10% of what we do at the Funeral Consumers Alliance is, like, answering people's questions and, like, providing resources. But, like, 90% of what we do is literally just trying to seek out prices, because they don't make it easy to shop for funeral home prices by not posting them online. A lot of funeral homes, they just recently did, the FTC did a sweep of, like, undercover people, like, going to try to get prices from funeral homes. And 15% of the funeral homes that they, were in their sweep were not complying with the funeral rule, right? Like, they wouldn't even provide prices to people now, today, under the current regulation. And it would be so
Wow.
much easier to tell whether or not funeral homes were in compliance at all if you just required them to post on their website, because then you can just Google it and easily see, as opposed to having to call them. And a lot of funeral homes, having now done hundreds of these calls, like, will really, like, pressure you to give a lot of your personal information before they give you prices, will, like, make it basically not easy for you to get these prices from them, basically. And so that's one piece of it. They were also looking into whether or not they should, like, revise the embalming disclosure, which is a disclosure that funeral homes are required to provide on their general price lists to tell you that embalming is not required by law, right? And that wording of that disclosure was super difficult to understand, because it was basically saying, like, in some cases, if you're doing a viewing, they made it seem as if it might be required by law, but it's actually just funeral homes policies themselves, not the law, that may require you to do an embalming. But for so many reasons, especially like religious reasons, there's plenty of religions that are against embalming. That is a super helpful amendment as well, to just make that more understandable. And then the third thing that I will say, even though there's like a bunch of things that they're looking at, is making sure third party fees, they're considering making sure third party fees are listed on the general price list. So for example, if you go to a funeral home and you get their general price list and you want a cremation, they're going often, sometimes they have an in-house crematory, but often they're going to a third party for that cremation, and they might not list those third party fees on their general price list at all. And that could be another like $400, right? So then a lot of times consumers will be surprised when they actually get their bill and be like, wait, what's this extra $400 doing here? Right? And that's a non-trivial expense to just be surprised by, you know?
Well, so that sounds great that they're considering those changes, and I hope they go through.
Yeah, I didn't realize that they were going to be doing this sort of undercover sweep recently. And so I'm really hoping that their findings will make it more likely that they're going to actually decide to, you know, basically require funeral homes to be more transparent about their pricing. And honestly, like, I do think there, I mean, there have been people like investors who've reached out to me and been like, hey, like, when do you think this is going into effect? Because like they're basically assuming that a lot of these funeral homes are going to have to lower their prices because there's data out there that shows that funeral homes that show their prices on their website and are transparent about their pricing versus funeral homes that are not are 30% cheaper, right? And so I'm just hoping that just generally from an access perspective, that this regulation will help so many more people just be able to afford a funeral at all, right?
And that's going to make a big difference.
Yeah, I really, really like, fingers crossed. Like I was on this panel for the FTC back in September to like testify, and I think by far the most liberal person on this panel. I was like, we should have disclosures for everything. Like,
It's
and
true.
so I think I was maybe not making a ton of friends in the funeral industry after that particular event, but yeah, I would love there to be. I mean, it's 2024, right? Like, if you can, this is one of the things I said in that workshop is like, there, a funeral home is the third most expensive thing that the average consumer buys after a house and a car. Like, imagine if people expected you. Right? Like, people have no idea what funerals cost, right? Like, imagine if you just didn't know how much your house cost, right? Before you walked in the door. Like, people have a general sense. The fact that you can just go on Zillow, right, is so much easier for people. And most of those times when you're buying your house and your car, you're not grieving, right? And funerals are different from both of those consumer goods and every other consumer good because you're not legally required to buy a house or a car. You are legally required. I mean, a funeral home is basically the one thing in America, basically, that you're legally required to buy because you can't just dump a buddy in the woods. Like, you literally are required to either bury or cremate. And then in some states, you can do, you know, water cremation or, you know, body composting. But my point is that it's a required thing that you have to buy.
Yeah, so true. And then to think that the pricing is so obscure and variable too, from one place to another.
Absolutely. Like, a cremation, in my opinion, is a commodity, right? A cremate, you're basically getting the same thing from, you know, shop A versus shop B, right? And the fact that you know, it can vary from like $700 to like $4,000 is bananas.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And
Yeah.
if there were transparent pricing, consumers would take care of that right away. They would make their choice, and
Totally.
they would help drive that price down.
Right. And one of the things that like the funeral directors like to say who are opposing this, you know, proposed regulation or change to the regulation is that like funeral, they always say, oh, you know, we did some survey of our customers. And the survey said that, you know, funeral consumers don't shop based on price. They really like to say that. And it's just like, okay, well, if they don't shop based on price, then it shouldn't matter whether you post your prices online because the people who do shop by price will be able to utilize it. And the people who don't, it doesn't make any difference.
Doesn't matter. They won't look up the prices
Right.
if they're accurate about that, but they don't shop based on price because the prices aren't available. That's the
Right,
real
exactly. That's the thing
reason.
is they were like, oh, how many people were looking for prices online? But it's just like, they had a survey where they asked people that and they were like, it was like less than 0.1% or whatever based on their survey from the National Funeral Directors Association. And it's just like, wait just a second. Like, if it's not there for them to find, right, then why would they try to find the prices online? The question is, if they were available, would they actually search for the prices online? And I think the answer is unambiguously yes. Like, that's how we shop nowadays. Like, this is the 21st century.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, gosh, our hour has flown by so quickly of talking together. But one last question I just wanted to ask. We've already talked all about a lot of the changes that you see as necessary. But if you had a magic wand and could create the ideal death care system, what would you do? What would that system look like?
Yeah, I really would love to see a system where we just break down the silos, basically. Like, I think, and this is something that I think that there are a lot of healthcare, like hospices, that are moving towards or wanting to move towards a model like this, but like a model where you have a care team and they all talk to each other, right? Where you have your death doula talking to your chaplain, talking to your hospice nurse, talking to your financial planner or your financial advisor, talking to your therapist, like, and they're all in conversation together over how to provide you the best care. Like, I think that this is, I mean, there are some places that have a model that's kind of like this in the sense that, like, hospices might have an in-house chaplain or a social worker or volunteers and things like that. But I would love to see that model applied more holistically and not even just at end of life, like for everybody, right? Like, I think that we all should have care teams of people who are not in these silos who are all talking to each other. I would love to see that.
Wow, me too. And that's yeah, so well said. And that's just something aspirational for us to be thinking about and thinking of how we can move toward that. And so I'll remind listeners, I'm talking with Isabel Knight. Her website is thedeathdesigner.com. And Isabel, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to chat with you today.
Of course. Thank you. This was awesome.
Yeah, really fun. I feel like we could just go on and on. So we'll have to do this again. We'll get together for another episode.
Yeah,
All
totally.
right, take care.
Thank you. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Isabel Knight and found it useful. I was happy to share information about the National Home Funeral Alliance because I think that's an organization that many of us should belong to just to receive resources and kind of stay in touch with what's happening in the home funeral industry. And it's free to be a member, so I think that's a great idea. And I also really enjoyed learning about human-centered design and talking with Isabel about how it could be applied to all of healthcare, not just the end of life, and why it's so important that we consider that perspective. So I hope you found some nuggets of information that are inspiring to you as well. If you enjoy this content, be sure to tell other people about it who might benefit from listening. And also make sure you subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. That's really helpful to make sure this show gets shown to people who are looking for information like this. And remember, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support to learn how you can make contributions to keep the show on the air. Come to the show notes page at eolupodcast.com for lots of other information. You'll be able to find all the archives there. I also have gift guides on the website that you can view if you're looking to buy a gift for someone who's grieving or a caregiver or being cared for. So some helpful ideas if you need to buy a gift and aren't sure what to get someone, you can check those out on the webpage at eolupodcast.com. And I'll be back next week with a new interview. I'll be talking with Doctors Gloria Horsley and Frank Powers, who are going to be talking about the secrets of senior dating. And these two are a couple who met each other in their 80s, and they talk about dating after loss and grief and finding a new companion for the rest of life. It's a wonderful, delightful conversation. I loved meeting them and hearing about the book they've written on senior dating. So I think it's a lot of fun. So make sure you tune in next week and hear that interview. Until then, remember that we're here for love. That's what Gloria and Frank remembered, and they found it again in their lives, even later in life. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious existence. Bye-bye.